We have a Brown County proceeding, and I understand that they may also be available in Brown County awaiting. Is that correct?
No, I'm here.
Okay. You're both in the same location?
Yes, we are, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you. Our file number is A191440 in the matter of the welfare of the child of SAF AJF. We don't see you yet, but that may be because you're not yet speaking long enough to be shown. Once you do, I suspect we'll keep you on. What we ask, as you know, each of you will be provided 15 minutes, up to 15 minutes, and you should have the time available there to you so you can see the time. And appellant will have 5 additional minutes for rebuttal. And what we ask you to do is identify your name for the record when you approach the podium. And so if you're ready, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Stephen Groshen, and I'm here representing mother and father, who are the appellants in this matter. Mother and father respectfully requesting that this court reverse the district court's order terminating their parental rights. There's going to be 2 primary reasons, the first which is paramount, being that the district court abused its discretion when it determined that termination of mother and father's rights with respect to the child, JF, was in JF's best interest. The second issue, which is kind of subsumed by the first issue, is that the district court abused its discretion by concluding that mother committed egregious harm with respect to that child. So, brief summary of the case. This case is really about the county moving through the termination process too fast, using the egregious harm basis to avoid any genuine reunification efforts, not giving mother or father enough time to address their underlying parenting issues. And as a result of this, their rights were prematurely terminated, and this all happened within the context of a seasoned guardian ad litem recommending that the district court not terminate and continue the CHIPS proceeding for a short period of about 3 months. So I'll start with the best interest analysis.
Before you do, Mr. Groshen, just to clarify, then I did not see an objection, and apparently the parties agree the court did make a finding of egregious harm, prima facie finding pursuant to the statute and rule early on, if not at the initial hearing in this matter.
That is correct, Your Honor. That happened.
Thank you. You may continue.
Jumping on to that question, so there was a prima facie finding, but it is also possible under the statute, if the court does not find by clear and convincing evidence egregious harm later on after a hearing, that it may order reunification efforts. So that ties into the overall discretion the court has as far as options before taking the ultimate decision to terminate. Again, with respect to the best interest factors, what we have here is essentially kind of a truncated timeline where the child was removed in April of 2019. There's a case plan around May 5th of 2019, and the CHIPS and the termination trial take place in mid-July. So that's about 2-3 months of actual working on the case plan. The outgoing case plan, and again, I'm not arguing that it was absolutely required to do reunification efforts under the prima facie, and I'll touch on that in a moment too. But what the case plan did say was to attend individual and couples therapy, take parenting classes, and supervise visits. So mother and father were complying with all aspects of this case. And what I expect respondents' argument to be is that the progress wasn't enough, or there wasn't good enough progress, so to speak. But if you look at the arc of the case, it makes intuitive sense that parents require intervention from the state with respect to the care for their children may start out in one place, and then as they work the case, go through therapy, follow the plan, they start to shift, accept more responsibility, and work harder on the case. And that's the trend we start to see, but there wasn't enough time to show more significant results. So the argument's not that the children should have been handed back immediately in July. The argument is that the original target date was October of 2019, that the parents should have had more of an opportunity to continue working through the plan in order to eventually lead to reunification. So I'll also touch base on, there's no abuse of JF here. There's no record. There were visits from social workers and the guardian ad litem.
But you would acknowledge that, I know that evidence was disputed, but that there was evidence to support the finding that other children, namely the Fromm children, had experienced egregious harm while in mother's care, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
So it doesn't matter that it wasn't the child that's the subject of this particular proceeding, right?
Well, it does for the best interest, because they're considering the best interest of JF and not necessarily the entire group of children. And as far as, there's a 6 children in total at the home, including JF, and the other 2 who are mother's biological children, there was no allegations of abuse with respect to them either. Now, they observed some things. I don't want to overstretch that. So that happened, but there's no direct abuse to them. And I know the goal is not 50%, right? The goal is 100%. That's what we're working toward here. But if half the children in the house at the time of termination, there isn't a significant case of abuse on them. It's directed at 3 specific children. I think that goes toward the predictive aspect of whether mother and father would abuse JF in the future. And with respect to that point, there simply isn't enough data to determine how they will, that they would abuse JF at the time of termination. So there are some underlying issues, personality disorders. As I noted earlier, at trial, both mother and father acknowledged some of their shortcomings and that they're working toward that. And again, that ties into that overall arc of, as they're moving through this case, the criminal case had ended, and now they're focusing, they're acknowledging things through therapy. I would argue that's the point of therapy, is someone doesn't acknowledge something right away, they work on it, they slowly start to change. And then the idea would be to check back in October, just a short continuance of about 3 months, and see the parents' progress. Now, if they hadn't made any progress, then at that point, the district court could again consider termination.
But isn't that within the district court's discretion whether it extends that 6-month period out of where to do exactly what you're suggesting the court should have done?
Of discretion given the overall record of the file. Again, that there is an abuse of JF, that the parents at the time of termination are working on the case plan. They are acknowledging through testimony at trial that they have shortcomings. And lastly, kind of touching on the facts that I think are primary to the best interest, is the guardian ad litem initially recommended termination. She thought that termination was in the best interest of the children. But as she interacted more with mother and father and with the therapist, she spoke with both of them and had some home visits, she changed her recommendation to not terminate mother and father's parental rights. Her advice to the court was a brief continuance. I believe she said 60 to 90 days in order to give mother and father more time to work the plan. And I'll touch on what I believe the district court's concern was the age of JF. So there was this balance between moving JF out of the house if they eventually do not succeed on the plan, and trying to get him out of the house before a certain age, because the guardian ad litem did testify that with younger children, it's generally easier. We have her other testimony, which we have to balance, of JF had established a bond with his parents. And the district court didn't make that finding that he had established a bond and that he was healthy and happy within mother and father's home. So with respect to the keeping him young, he's only 3 months older in October. And so that's not a significant amount of time in order to create more distress on him. They would have just waited 3 more months. I argue it wouldn't have been a significantly more, whatever that negative impact is, because again, we're not dealing with concrete numbers. We're trying to measure through what the psychologists are saying. Wouldn't have been significant in that sense. I will also briefly note that some of the comments on JF's lack of crying as he's doing supervised visits and parenting, I would say that's not entirely significant because children react in different ways to their parents leaving. There isn't a set emotion that a child has to feel when they're removed from their parents. And just because JF's not bawling every single night doesn't mean he doesn't miss mother and father. I'll move on to my second point of the egregious harm. So as stated earlier to your question, Your Honor, that yes, if there's a prima facie showing, reunification efforts are not required by the district court. However, if at a later hearing there's a finding that egregious harm has not been shown by clear and convincing evidence, Judge, do you have a question?
No, you can continue.
Okay. If it's not found by clear and convincing evidence, then the district court can again bring reunification efforts in. So I want to talk about the definition of egregious harm and just get to the core of the argument. Essentially, the issue here is that I think the district court took the interpretation of egregious harm too broadly. So there is that MEH, I believe, the case with malnourishment over in a very long extended period of time. And that case cites another case which has to do with a physical assault. And in that nature, those are both physical things that are easily measurable. And in this case, essentially the egregious harm, that's the point of the argument from both sides, is this driving conduct by mother on a specific date. And essentially what the district court did, it made two findings. And again, these would be under clear error because these are factual findings. The first finding was that mother had the intent to drive, to create assault fear, essentially, the specific intent crime. Again, in the criminal trial, the judge had found that mother did not show that intent. Again, that's a different standard. I'll concede that point. That's beyond a reasonable doubt. However, after watching the video, and the video is relatively shaky, it is a squad camera video of actual security camera footage. So the timing isn't entirely clear. But based on mother's testimony and the video itself, there's not enough to show assault fear. The second basis that the district court used was to just conclude that reckless driving itself could satisfy egregious harm. And the concern with that is egregious harm is a more powerful, if you will, basis for a CHIPS petition because it removes reunification efforts. There are reunification efforts for the county with respect to the parents.
I'm confused about this. I mean, I know I understand your argument, but in this case, there were reunification efforts made, right? I mean, you've talked about them. The parents are in therapy and things like that. So I'm confused.
So, Judge, the reunification efforts, to the extent they were there, were only 3 months. So I would argue that they weren't sufficient. If we want to, we can call them reunification because there was a case plan, but the very, very short period of time, if the district court had made a finding of that reasonable efforts were made, I would argue that they were not. They had not done enough to establish reasonable efforts of reunification. So lastly, just touching on that standard of reckless driving, again, the second finding that the district court used, simply because the child is afraid should not be enough to satisfy the egregious harm standard when there's no physical harm to the child. And again, I would distinguish the case law on the basis that the malnourishment had physical harm to the child. If we're simply going on a basis of a parent can be negligent, and then that would establish the egregious harm standard, even if there's no physical harm, I argue that's too broad of a reading. And the court's question may be, well, is there any sort of other basis? Yeah, injurious environment, palpably unfit. They could use other bases for a CHIPS adjudication in those types of cases while still maintaining the reunification efforts requirement. For these reasons, parents are going to respectfully request this court reversed the district court's ruling. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. counsel for respondent, as soon as you are ready, you may approach, and please identify yourself, and then you may begin.
Good morning. Taller than you. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Jill Jensen. I represent respondent Brown County Human Services in this matter. We are requesting that this court affirm the district court's termination of parental rights. I will first just briefly address appellant's argument regarding egregious harm. As this court is aware, the district court need only find two statutory bases for termination of parental rights. One statutory basis. In this case, the district court did find two egregious harm committed by both parents and palpable unfitness by both parents. So in essence, there is an uncontested palpable unfitness statutory ground here, and I don't believe this court even needs to address whether or not the court erred or abused its discretion in concluding that appellant SF committed egregious harm on a child.
Ms. Jensen, with regard to that, did the court make findings that reunification efforts were met with regard to the other statutory basis, or is it your position it's not required?
It would be my position that once that court has found the prima facie basis, that reasonable efforts are not required. If they ultimately come to a trial and find no egregious harm, there's no requirement in the statute that they go back and say, well, we're going to start over. And on that same point, I would also point out that since counsel has indicated that reasonable efforts were made, but only 3 months, I would note that the rules require that a permanency trial on a termination petition to occur within 60 days, which is 2 months.
But again, just to clarify, that is presupposing no, and the reason for that is because a bypass finding has been made by the court, in this case, egregious harm. And so would not, and the whole point being, the statute also makes reference to the relieving up until there is a hearing, and this would be the hearing, I suspect, to which the court would either conclude there is or is not egregious harm. So my question is, assuming the court had found, this goes to the main point you're making here, is that the alternative basis, I just question whether we can address the alternative basis without concluding whether the court erred in finding egregious harm present.
I don't believe that there's any, if the court were to find egregious harm, I don't believe, to find that egregious harm did not occur, I don't believe reasonable efforts would then be required. I don't think that's what the statute uses of may.
Thank you.
Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. With respect to the child's best interest, respondent does not believe that the district court abused its discretion. The standard is whether the district court's findings are supported by substantial evidence and therefore not clearly erroneous that support its conclusions of law. As a result, resulting in the district court abusing its discretion. In this case, all of the district court's findings with respect to the child's best interest are supported by substantial evidence in the record, and that therefore the court did not abuse its discretion. I think first and foremost, I'd like to note that the court did make the requisite findings under Minnesota Rule of Juvenile Protection Procedures 39.05, subdivision 3, subdivision parentheses B3, and each of those findings is supported by substantial evidence. First, the court did consider the child interested in the relationship. The court explicitly considered the fact that the majority of the testimony supported that the child did love these parents, in concluding that it was still in the child's best interest to terminate parental rights. In doing so, the court found that the child was only upset once during supervised visits. This was supported by the visit summaries. It also found that the child did not cry and was easily rejected when indicating missing the parents, which is absolutely relevant to the child's interest in the relationship. And that is supported by the testimony of the foster parents who were the mother's father and stepmother. have professed and indicated that they love JF, but the district court also noted that the parents would profess to love the children that they abused. SF explicitly testified that she loves BF, which is the child she drove at with the vehicle and participated in abuse of for 2 years. And the district court essentially found that while these parents profess to have an interest in the parent-child relationship, their actions contradict it due to their failure to acknowledge their own parenting deficits. And that's where we get into the competing interests of the child and how they outweigh the parent's interest in the relationship and the child's interest in the relationship. The district court did find that the parents were would be unable to provide a safe, stable home free of violence and abuse for the child for the reasonably foreseeable future. And that is also supported by substantial evidence in the record. The parents continuously, including at trial, minimized, denied, and rationalized their abuse of these three children, as well as failed to realize the impact of watching that abuse and normalizing that abuse on mothers to biological children.
But in fairness, they'd been in therapy for, what, 3 months at the time of the trial? I mean, is that enough time to recognize and to come to the assessment that we would hope parents would, under the circumstances, to understand the detrimental impact on the children and address their own mental health needs to prevent that behavior in the future?
And I absolutely understand your point, but I think what is ignored is that this case was opened in 2018. The termination of parental rights petition was not filed until April of 2019. And there is testimony from the social worker that she spoke with both parents in November of 2018 during a home visit about the need to go to therapy. She also testified that she had brought a case plan for JF, but they didn't feel comfortable signing at that time. So the parents knew or should have known that they should be in therapy months before this case ever went to trial. And during that, they perpetuated in this belief up till trial. Even at trial, father testified that the children were coerced to make allegations by their stepfather, that the children had a choice in how long they were going to sleep on a cold concrete floor. And they had a choice whether they were going to do that at all because they could have simply apologized. This is the same pattern of failure to recognize the ingrained parenting deficits that's perpetuated throughout this case. When it first came in, the parents said that the children had been brainwashed. They denied all the allegations. In March 2019, which was 4 months before the trial, father said that he neither knows how he could have been a better parent nor what he could have changed. And this is in finding 36.2 of the district court's order and is supported by the court exhibits of the parenting assessment.
Well, isn't that part of that due to the fact that both parents were facing criminal charges at that point? I mean, that's obviously part of what delayed their acceptance of responsibility, et cetera, isn't it?
I don't know exactly what delayed their acceptance of responsibility. I think that would be, a good point. Obviously, you don't want to implicate yourself. But at the same time, in April of 2019, there was surveillance footage found showing that the majority of the children's allegations were true. They were sleeping on the floor in only their underwear or laying on the floor for multiple hours at a time. Mother did drive at the children, consistent with what BF had said. And both of their criminal trials had concluded by the time we did go to a termination of parental rights trial. And at that time, they still made the same statements, albeit acknowledging a little bit more, that they had made prior to their criminal cases resolving.
Ms. Jensen,
yes.
Just to clarify the change of circumstances, when you mentioned the first number of months, the children and the child in particular involved here remained in the home, if I understand correctly, until that incident involving the automobile, the assault, and the new criminal charges. And so it's at that point, if I understand correctly, that essentially the county decided, and soon thereafter with its TPR and egregious harm, decided to bypass reunification. So basically, that incident is what changed the county's direction. So whatever efforts were made or whatever therapy offered, the child was still in the home, in other words, so the parents would presume the child's going to continue to stay in a home, and then all of a sudden, at the time of the EPC in April and the new petition, we're going right to a trial with a bypass of reunification efforts at that stage.
Yes, Your Honor, and I think it's important to note that neither the social worker, the investigating officer, or the guardian ad litem believed that that child, JF, should remain in the home when this case came before the court in 2018. The three biological children of father were all removed. The two biological children of mother were not removed for the same reason that JF was not removed, but they did ultimately, or at that same time, essentially become removed because the father of those children filed an order for protection, and ultimately that father gained full custody of those children. So I don't think it would be safe to say that the parents did not know they needed to make changes in their parenting abilities or in their mental health.
Does that give some credence, though, the timing to the guardian ad litem's recommendation that notwithstanding that incident, and there had only been approximately 6 months or so of reunification efforts in a typical scenario, that more time could be allowed? And do you believe the court made sufficient findings to address that opinion?
Well, first, I think it's important to note that while the guardian ad litem did advocate for a 90-day extension in order for the parents to demonstrate that they could potentially parent, she was not able to, she testified that she did not know if what they needed to accomplish could be accomplished. She, when asked if she believed the parents could parent in the reasonably foreseeable future, she stated she did not know. And I do believe that the court made sufficient findings regarding doing the termination at that present time instead of extending it for a few months. The district court found that the child was of a young age, and the guardian ad litem and the social worker agreed that the younger a child is, the easier it is for them to adjust to a new home. And I think the court's findings on that would therefore, while a district court could potentially reach a different result, that does not necessarily mean there's an abuse of discretion simply because the evidence could have been considered another way. The standard is whether there was substantial evidence, and there was substantial evidence. And the fact that, and the district court further concluded that the parents would not be able to parent in the reasonably foreseeable future. So for that reason, it would make no sense to extend another 3 months if they would be unable to do it. So for those reasons, I do think the district court's findings are sufficient.
Thank you.
Ms. Jensen, going back to the issue of egregious harm, and I understand your argument that we don't need to reach it, but appellant is arguing that I think the harm must be physical, and here with it, basically in a charge of assault fear, there was no such harm. Is there any case law that recognizes egregious harm with a non-physical consequence?
But I think more important than that is that even though the district court concluded that recklessly driving egregious harm, the court did find the intentional aspect that the criminal court did not reach that higher standard, if that makes sense. I think I did address it in my brief that obviously egregious harm is a broader standard in child protection cases, and I do think the district court's findings properly found that the assault, in the second degree assault, did occur.
Okay.
And the final thing I just wanted to note for your honors similar to another case in which a child was not abused, which was cited in my brief, which is the in the matter of the welfare of TFD, which is 374 Northwest 2nd at 206. And I see my time is up, so I would just request that this court affirm the district court's findings because she did not abuse her discretion in terminating parental rights.
Thank you, counsel. And counsel for appellant, if you wish to provide rebuttal, you may do so.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll be brief. Let's touch on TMD, the case respondent referenced quickly. The facts in that case are important. So it was, I believe, the parent in that case was around 32, 34 years old and had a significant cognitive impairment. And they had made effort after effort to teach her the skills to take care of her children, and she was unable to learn those skills over an extended period of time. So with respect to that case, it's quite a bit different than this case. So yes, that case had a child that had not experienced any harm, similar to JF in this case, but in that case, they've exhausted essentially all other options with respect to that child. I also wanted to touch on Minnesota statute 260.012 NG. That's the reasonable effort statute after the clear and convincing evidence if it's not found. It's worded a little bit odd where it states may only, which suggests there's some discretion involved, but the discretion may not be exercised unless egregious harm is not found by clear and convincing evidence. I wanted to clarify that essentially the argument in appellant's brief is it would be an abuse of discretion to not consider it. So that's the request to remand. If egregious harm is not found by clear and convincing evidence, to remand to the district court to determine whether reasonable efforts should be made, not making the argument that it's automatic, but that it would be an abuse of discretion not to. Finally, I just wanted to touch on, no one said that mother and father absolutely would not be ready to parent in October. There's no testimony on that. There's some testimony on it may be difficult, they're going to have to work hard, but there's no testimony saying we know when we get to October that we're just wasting time. There's no way it's possible for them to work through the plan and develop the skills they need. Does the court have any questions?
Mr. Groshen, how do you reply to the responsive argument that the existence of the egregious harm statutory ground or the finding is immaterial? I mean, really, your challenge to that is immaterial because the district court also terminated based on palpable unfitness. Basically, there were two grounds for termination. You've challenged one, but you've left the other one unchallenged. So does it matter whether the second one is valid or invalid?
Good question, Your Honor. So it matters for two reasons. For the first reason, the best interest analysis applies to both. So once there's one statutory ground found, the court moves on to the best interest analysis. So
I understand the best interest argument remains in any event, but with respect to the first argument, I guess the way you ordered them in your brief, the first argument challenges egregious harm. Do we need to address that?
You do, Your Honor, and the reason why is that the court erred by finding by clear and convincing evidence there was egregious harm, and because there was not egregious harm by clear and convincing evidence, the court has to consider the reunification efforts under that statute I previously referenced.
And then describe for me, if you could, flesh that out further, and so what impact would that have on the palpable unfitness finding?
So the with respect to the palpable unfitness, the court could not terminate until it found reasonable efforts had been made. But it didn't make those findings because it had the egregious harm basis also. So it would have to go back down and make that finding. If the court found that reasonable efforts do not need to be made, and we're setting aside the best interest argument, just to address this question, then the court, if it found reasonable efforts did not have to be made, then it would be sustained on the palpable unfitness. Just within that avenue. Does that clarify, Judge Johnson?
I think it does. Thank you.
If there are no further questions, I will rest.
Very well. Thank you to both counsel. We appreciate your comments this morning and your availability by ITV, and we will take this matter under advisement if it's expedited because of its child protection nature. So we have that in mind and issue a ruling accordingly. So you each have a good day. Thank you.
Thank you.